So, welcome again. We are here at the Accented Philosophy Podcast, and today we are talking about anarchism. My name is Andy.
And hi, I'm Ezekiel.
Okay, Ezekiel, so we want to talk about anarchism. Do you want to begin?
Yes, so maybe we can begin with a brief definition of what anarchism really means, because I feel like a lot of people are confused, and in fact, we are also sometimes confused. When we hear about anarchism, I think the first reaction is to think about this, you know, French saying, which is ni Dieu ni maître, no God, no master, right? And what comes to mind is this idea that anarchism is simply the absence of any sort of authority, whether it is the state or religion or anything that would produce regulations that could be oppressive to people.
Right, but it's also worth saying perhaps at the beginning that this is a very or a relatively new way of understanding anarchism, and originally the word, I was surprised to learn, is in use since the 1640s, where it was used as a term to attack people who are against the lawful order, right? So it was used as a bad word. He's an anarchist in the sense of he's not supporting, you know, God and the country. And this is also still there, right? When, especially when politicians talk about anarchy or anarchism, it's not a positive utopia. It's often put there as something that we should be afraid of.
Yes, it's often used, I think, as a way to undermine any political claim that is that goes against the mainstream political trend. It's easy to you know, say that someone is an anarchist, therefore what they're saying doesn't really make sense, because maybe we kind of think of anarchism as this utopian thing and we don't take it very seriously, because although we may agree on principle with some of its maxims, generally we tend to think that it is not something that can realistically happen. So it's an, I don't know if we're right in thinking that this is the case, but it is an easy way to undermine someone's claim when we maybe disagree with it or when we think it lacks justification.
Yes, and now how would we actually describe anarchism? It is pretty difficult, right? If you read about the history of anarchism, it's not at all clear what the claim actually is. And various people have self-proclaimed themselves as anarchists who have widely different views on what they are actually supporting. So you have obviously, you have a strong association between Marxism and anarchism historically, because it was the struggle of the workers in the 19th century to be heard and to be to get more political representation, and this served as the basis for both communism and anarchism, and both these utopias were there together and essentially proclaiming the same thing. We get rid of the oppression of the capital and the capitalists, and we create a society in which people are free and equal.
Yeah.
And so this is the one way of seeing it, right? And then you had, you know, Christian anarchists like Tolstoy, or like the ideas that in the early years of Christian life, these early Christian communities would have been self-organizing in some anarchist way. And then you have the people who say that abolishing money or abolishing capitalism is a form of anarchism. So what would you say is actually the essence of anarchism?
So I think that we should distinguish between anarchism as simply the absence of any sort of state or any sort of regulation, which is not, I think, what people mean when they talk about anarchism. Let's say that's one definition. And then anarchism as any kind of alternative society, a society that is not run according to, you know, capitalist rules, could be defined as an anarchist society. So if it means alternative, then the possibilities are endless. There could be many forms of anarchist societies. If it means the absence of any sort of government and simply a society that's self-determined, again, self-determination does not mean absence of rules. It just means that the rules come from something else. They're inherent to the structure of society. The society decides for itself. It's not subjected to an external influence or the power of a group within that society. So when we talk about self-determination, it doesn't necessarily mean the absence of rule. I don't think in any, I mean, that I'm not a historian, but I don't think we can find an example of a society that had no form of regulation whatsoever. So
something like the Wild West perhaps comes to mind, right? A society in which you have a very big country, a very low population density, very big areas in which people are the owners of their own farms, yeah, and relatively little state regulation just because the state doesn't have the resources to regulate anything. And then you get this Wild West feeling of people taking justice into their own hands. But the question there is, at least, you know, the movie version of it. It's not clear if, or yeah, at least to me, it's not clear if this actually was like that. But but this already points, you know, to a problem. When you have an absence of state regulation, then you still need some form of regulation. I mean, they're still criminals and you still need to catch them. And what will replace state policing in a situation like this? And in the Wild West, famously, you know, in the movies, you see those lone cowboys taking the law into their own hands. And this often goes wrong, we can imagine, right? Or in other societies, you have what is called vigilantism, where you have citizens patrolling and enforcing whatever law they see fit, which has often been misused or used for racial oppression also, right? You had patrolling Ku Klux Klan members in the South United States, terrorizing people in the name of imposing order. So how can we make sure that when we have citizens taking security into their own hands, that they are actually going to serve the ideals of justice rather than their own interests or preoccupations?
Yeah, so that, I think it's interesting you mentioned the Wild West, because I think, ironically, this is from the Wild West, this kind of anarchist society. And I don't know if we should call it a society. It's more of a pre-society, I think, but we can discuss that. But it's this idea of, you know, no regulation, everyone doing whatever they want and following their own self-interest. That gave birth to this very capitalist society that is, you know, America and the West in general. This idea of free market, this idea that everyone can be a self-made man, everyone can, you know, reach whatever goal they have if they work hard, and also this suspicion towards regulations and government, the idea that the government is necessarily against you as an individual. So yeah, that's a little ironic, because we don't consider this capitalist society an anarchist society, though the roots of that, you could argue, are pretty anarchist. It's really this idea of independence of people. But that's why I don't think we should define anarchism as complete independence. Instead, we should probably define it as a kind of society that is free from any oppressive power, whether it is the power of, you know, the economy or the government or a group of people. And there's simply an alternative way of doing politics that is, in fact, quite democratic. And I think this is, one answer to the question, how do you make sure that the anarchist society is not simply a society run by self-interest? It's because we need to make sure there is some democratic element in that.
I still don't see how this is supposed to be policed. So in a anarchist society, who catches the thieves?
Yeah.
What is the idea there?
So the police is an interesting question. You hear a lot of talks these days about, you know, defunding the police, for example. This idea that we should not public money should not go into the police because the police is the representation of an oppressive state. And we talked about this a little bit in the previous one. And therefore, we should defund them because their power is illegitimate by definition. I'm not sure what I think about that. I do think, obviously, an anarchist society doesn't mean no punishment for crimes. I think here it comes to what the people, when they come together, are capable of doing and what they can agree on together. That's why I think an anarchist society is a democratic society, maybe in its purest form. Then the question of who is selected to, you know, enforce the law is a different one. You know, you could think of a lot of alternative systems. For example, people who advocate for defunding the police sometimes say that it could be simply a matter of groups of people, like regular citizens, who make sure that society remains peaceful, and people may take turns in doing this. I don't know if this is really realistic, but this is a possibility. The idea that you don't need to have a particular group that has the job of doing whatever a government is saying they should do. It could simply be regular citizens discussing and coming to conclusions about what should be done, and then taking turns in the application of what should be done.
Right, so we do have some examples of this where regular citizens determine how a discourse is being conducted in the internet. Right, the internet is a good example of this, where in old times, and even, you know, we still remember those times, probably, or at least I do, before the internet. You had all this very regulated discourse through newspapers and books and journals and TV. And if you wanted to participate in that, you had to have a qualification. You had to be somehow integrated into this system or recognized as an expert in order to be given airtime to present your views. But the internet has changed all this. And now we are able to, every one of us can just go out there and proclaim whatever they want. And we generally see, I think, that this was not always a good thing. So I don't know if you agree, but I'm very critical of what has happened in terms of public discourse in the last 20 years, where you see that we have all sorts of really harmful things happening in terms of unregulated censorship, where big media companies like Google or Facebook are censoring discourse as they see fit without any public oversight. We see examples of really idiotic discourse like the anti-vaxxer movement, or, you know, supporters of Trump inciting violence in you know, response to perceived election fraud. And you have all these movements that are, or even worse things, you know, like flat earth movements and so on. I mean, one can say that this is valuable. It is valuable to have, you know, this plurality of opinions in the open, but one can also say that this is harmful, because in this way people who are not educated enough to make a good choice between all these alternatives are equally likely to pick the right or the wrong side of a debate, even if the wrong side is very wrong. If they lack the ability to judge the wrongness of a claim, then perhaps there is something to be said for a regulated media landscape that prevents them from hearing these false things. And Yeah, and so now, if this is a model for anarchism, then it doesn't look good if we make all our society like this. I mean, this would mean that the laws are being made by everyone, and everyone is, to a large extent, you know, anti-vaxxers, flat earthers, and such people. Do we really want to give so much power to a population that is not sufficiently educated to use that power?
It's a really difficult question. I think you could say there's a value in public discourse in and of itself. The fact that people are able to express their opinions just because they're people, they're citizens of a country, they have the right to say something about that, whatever that the content of their speech is. And then you have people who say, you know, when people talk, so this is the democratic process, even if they disagree, you can still come to some kind of consensus. So you could call that the majority, right? But the idea that when people get together, then something good comes from that, even if some disagree, that there is an intrinsic value in the democratic emergence of ideas and claims. I don't know if I really believe this. But this is something you could say, that the people's voice is valuable no matter what, and good things come from that. And also you could say, well, even if the people is wrong, because they are sovereign in a democracy, they should, you know, their voice should be respected anyway. So if they elect Trump, well, Trump is a legitimate president. If they chose Brexit, well, Brexit should happen. You know, anything the people want should be respected. Because for some reason we attribute a lot of, you know, intrinsic value to the people and the people's voice. Again, that's one way. So the internet, is the internet an anarchist society? Well, it is if we think of anarchism as this absence of regulation and, you know, a place where people can just do whatever they want to express their opinions any which way. Which is not, I think, what proponents of anarchism today believe. So
can you say a little more? In what sense is it not what they believe, or what do they believe?
Well, again, I think, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but generally speaking, anarchists today would advocate for an alternative kind of society that rejects the rules of capitalism and also any form of oppression, and they would advocate for the kind of society where harmful speeches and, you know, lack of respect for people's dignity would be, you know, punished, right? You think about people like Chomsky, for example. I don't think he would advocate for complete freedom to say whatever you want without repercussions. So I don't know if the internet would be a good example of that kind of anarchist society if we take it as simply an alternative to capitalist societies that aims at the realization of, you know, people's well-being. And I guess it comes down to the idea of freedom. I think the main idea behind anarchism is this belief that everyone's free, people are born free, and that you should not enslave them any, you know, one way or another. And if you harm them, if you're being disrespectful,
You're contradicting yourself now. I mean, this doesn't work. You cannot cherry pick, you know, a contradictory position. So on the one hand, you say people should be free. On the other hand, you say we should be responsible for what we say, and we are only allowed to say what does not harm the dignity of others. And this is such a rubber band description that, you know, whatever anybody doesn't like harms their dignity. So you want to have some totally unregulated censorship where people are randomly, you know, accused. And this describes more or less the internet of today, where people are randomly accused of harming the dignity of someone. And at the same time, you do this in the name of the freedom of people. I mean, I think we have to decide there. Either we sure. proclaim okay. that I'll... freedom is the most important, where we, you know, really have freedom to say whatever we like, or we say that we should have some kind of censorship of opinions. But then it seems that having this censorship in a well-regulated legal framework is preferable to having it yeah. just occur randomly. So how no, do
sure.
you reconcile this?
I'm not sure what I believe myself. For sure, the idea behind anarchism is the idea that everyone is free and oppression is never, it can never be legitimized, right? But I don't think it's necessarily oppression and the absence of freedom when someone tells you that there's some things you should not say. So
in what sense is telling
if you say something harmful and someone tells you this is not acceptable, you shouldn't be saying that. It's not necessarily a threat to your freedom. I don't think freedom is just simply being able to do whatever you want. So I think it's
an anarchist. So what is freedom then? What is this yeah. freedom then? If it's not the freedom to do whatever you want or to say whatever you want. I mean, we're not even talking about to do. I mean, to do, you can say, okay, the freedom ends where I harm somebody else. Then I'm not allowed to do these things that harm others. But to say or to have an opinion, it doesn't seem to directly harm anyone. And
to have an opinion, certainly not. But to say it could. It depends. It depends if you are in a specific position, a position of power, and you can. The content of your speech can harm people in ways that will have repercussions in their social life, or if you perpetuate like systems of oppression and discrimination and all of that.
I don't know what this means really. Yeah. I mean, now we get it's into okay. this debate. No, it's interesting. I mean, we should perhaps explore this a little. I mean, we get into this debate about freedom of speech, which is very difficult, and I recognize that. There is a problem in saying that, whatever legitimizes oppression or discrimination is not permitted. And then I can ask, who does not permit it? Because if you do it in the name of anarchism, then it seems contradictory again. It seems like you're saying we shouldn't have a ruling class, we shouldn't have a law, we shouldn't have a government, but we still are not allowed to perform particular speech acts. And then I can ask, who is the instance who does not allow us to do this? And who regulates that? And so now you have replaced an orderly government that regulates speech with its laws and its parliament and its courts with yes. somehow an unregulated public opinion. And you know how easily this can go wrong. I mean, we had a Nazi state that shows how easily public opinion can be completely perverted to suppress legitimate opinions. We had a cultural revolution in China where similar things happened. So how do you make sure that this regulation of what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say in an anarchist system still works? Who guarantees that these distinctions between what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say are made sensibly?
So, yeah, so that this is where I think public discourse is important, because I don't think anarchism is the absence of any rules. I think a proper anarchist society, if we conceive it as an alternative society, like a more desirable society, maybe we can even call it an ideal society. I don't know. But anyway, society free of oppression doesn't mean the absence of rules. I don't think freedom is the absence of rules or the possibility to act however you please. So here, how do you regulate all of that? I think you do so through public discourse and through kind of like democratic dialogue where people come together and express their views and kind of find an agreement. And, maybe you can say it's a form of social contract theory, but we kind of find an agreement on what we consider acceptable or not and what is harmful or not. And I don't know if we need a government to tell us what is acceptable or not for us as the people. I think the people, if educated, and this is why education is a big part, I think, of a good anarchist society, if the people are informed enough, they're capable of identifying what their true interests are. And I think through public dialogue, they can express that, and we can then, you know, kind of like make a list of the things we value, we commonly, collectively value, and that we want to protect. And then when people express ideas that contradict this, we can talk again. I'm not saying we should punish them, you know, very strictly, like, you know, it can happen sometimes. If you say something that's against the doxa, I think a new dialogue should happen, not necessarily just the mere punishment. The doxa is always, you know, you should always adapt the doxa to the needs of society.
Yeah, and now you mentioned education, right? You said how important education is. So there comes the next question. Education can also be seen as a way to perpetuate beliefs that are wrong, that are supporting of the system, or it can be seen as a way to guard truth and to transmit true beliefs to the next generation. So education has a big role there, right? And if you say education is necessary for a free society, then the question is, who then regulates what the content of this education is going to be? Obviously, it's a big difference. There are, you know, perhaps in the United States, I think we have examples of groups influencing, for example, biology teaching, so that natural evolution is not taught as true, but as one option, and Christian, you know, creationism is taught as another option, and both are taught to be more or less equivalent to each other. And you see with this example that education itself is perhaps not so valuable if we don't specify how we arrive at what is the canonical content of this education, and what is supposed to be good content versus bad content, and which content actually makes people more educated rather than making them more disoriented. So what would you say that is? Is this not another way how, you know, these beliefs of society are in a hidden way inserted again into the discourse through the education of the young people?
Yeah, so how do we educate young people in this context? So education, well, there's two things. Education is not only about content. It's also about how we process this content. So obviously you have facts. You have things that are true, things that are wrong, and this should be ideally, there's no discussion about that, you know, but I understand it's not as easy as this. So we should not dismiss the fact that there is a scientific truth, and we can actually get it. We can reach this. But education is also about, you know, thinking critically. It's also teaching people how to process information, not only learn an information. So when you do this successfully, then you have a bunch of people who are able to receive something, think critically about it, come up with an opinion. I'm not saying people's opinion is necessarily valuable just because it's their opinion. Sometimes people's opinions are wrong, you know. But if they have this skill of, you know, being able to confront their opinion with other people's opinion and evaluate arguments, then I'm hopeful that we can get to some kind of collective knowledge of what we should be doing. At least we would all be able to think about it and talk about it, exchange, and then get, you know, some forms of solutions, which may mean some compromises, which is okay. But yeah, I think education is not only imposing facts on people, but it's also, you know, helping them processing these facts.
Okay, and so it would be through this processing, through the method, that some control is obtained, right? So you would say that the process is what controls the content, right? So a priority of the process over the content.
Yeah, I think we should obviously teach some facts, but we should also teach a method, you know, a structure of thinking. And this is what we're doing when we teach philosophy. We don't just, you know, teach about ideas and concepts and tell people, well, Kant thinks that we do, but we mostly teach them how to, you know, use that method to interpret whatever they encounter in the world.
Well, yes, in university, but in in primary school or early secondary school, you cannot really teach children how to themselves develop a method to evaluate whether creationism or natural evolution is right. So there we have to somehow give them the content with the authority of the system and say that you have to believe this because this is what our scientists have found out, right? In many cases, atomic theory, how the universe works, you know, astronomy, such things, physics, these are not things that the student can himself verify through any kind of process, right? This is content that still has to be transmitted as authoritative or true.
That's why I'm not saying we should get rid of the content. Obviously not. But we can at least teach them that, well, some people have asked these questions in the past. It means that these questions are valuable. It's valuable just to ask that question. And, you know, maybe when you do that, they can start thinking, well, maybe it's valuable to also ask this question and this question. How do you come up with an answer for that? So we're just kind of like pushing the buttons for them to become curious, you know. When they're very young, and we give some answers that are facts, and then we, you know, push them to ask more and more questions, and it goes on and on. And I think this is a very healthy process.
Yes. Okay. So let me one moment say that I find this discussion today, you know, delightfully controversial. And so if our listeners have any ideas and have their own opinions, it would be nice if they could contribute them. So if you go to Daily Philosophy and you can just Google that, and then you will get the site as the first result. If you go to Daily Philosophy, and find the post that is about this episode, then you can, at the bottom of it, add your comments. And it would be great if you would do this. I would be very interested to see what others are thinking about our topic here, because this is something that affects all our lives. It's not only, you see, we're not talking only about historical anarchism. We're talking about today's education. We're talking about today's internet and the debates about freedom and censorship in there. So this is something where everyone, I think, has an opinion. All right. But now let's go back perhaps a little to the history. We didn't talk at all about the history of anarchism yet. And you mentioned the social contract. So do you want to say a little something about how the social contract theorists relate to this idea of anarchism? Superficially, it would seem like this is quite the opposite. So you have this anarchic original society, and then comes the social contract and dismantles anarchism in favor of some kind of organized society. But it's not always like this, right?
No, so it's a bit ambiguous. So I think social contract theories come as a response to a kind of anarchist society, like the state of nature. So again, Hobbes would probably think that anarchism is undesirable and we need society, we need regulations. The need for anarchism in general originally often is associated with the rejection of property rights, you know, and this idea that, you know, like Proudhon said, property is theft, and the government being the ultimate, you know, possessor of goods and means is then the ultimate thief, right?
And this why would property be theft? Can you try to explain this a little bit? I mean, it's not immediately obvious, at least not if the property is a result of my own work, right? I can create value, and then this value can allow me to own something that I have created. So in what sense is property theft, really?
So it is in the sense that by owning something, you exclude others from that thing. And for people like Proudhon, I believe it is necessarily in conflict with the values of freedom and equality, values that he places above the value of property. And then you have Rousseau, who says, maybe I can read that quote that I have here, where he says, "The first man who, having enclosed a piece of ground, he thought himself of saying, 'This is mine,' and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society. From how many crimes, wars, and murders, from how many horrors and misfortunes might not anyone have saved mankind by pulling up the stakes or filling up the ditch and crying to his fellows, 'Beware of listening to this impostor, you are undone if you once forget that the fruits of the earth belong to us all and the earth itself to nobody.'" So Rousseau says this, and then because this has happened, then we're in a state of war and we're in big trouble and we need society. But in the perfect, maybe anarchist state, then the pre-political state, and there's no such thing as someone who says, "Well, this is mine." Obviously, the problem is then human nature. Maybe there is a distinction to be made between human nature and, you know, the what we're capable of. And in fact, Rousseau is clear in The Social Contract that he writes about what society can be and what men can be, not what they usually are. So there is a distinction here. So he has a first book where he talks about societies as they evolved historically, given what people usually do. But then The Social Contract is kind of the ideal picture of what people are capable of doing, but have not chosen to do because of their human nature and their instincts and impulses. Maybe anarchism is a form of ideal society when we take people as they are and with what they can do, you know, the capacities that they have, if they, you know, flourish, if they, you know, become the best versions of themselves to speak life. So, yeah.
Okay, so for Rousseau, it's not entirely clear then, is the anarchist society at the beginning of it in the state of nature, or is it the goal of the development of society where, you know, Rousseau's ideal society is itself a kind of anarchism? Would you say this?
I don't think so. Obviously, Rousseau doesn't talk about anarchism, you know, but I think so. He's often interpreted as someone who thought the state of nature was an ideal state and we corrupted it with society. That's not exactly what he says. But I don't, you can't really call Rousseau an anarchist writer, but you could say that if we take this, you know, the state of nature before, you know, corruption has spoiled it and before property has spoiled it, it is a form of ideal society, which could be akin to an anarchist society, or at least what we think of it today. It's not just the state of nature. There's kind of like a moment between this, the pure state of nature and society. Just be, you know, when people start to gather, but before it goes really bad. So I think this window could be what we could think of when we talk about anarchism.
But Rousseau's idea of ideal society also seems to be close to what you described before as, or perhaps what others have imagined as anarchist society, where it's not the absence, the complete absence of order that is desirable, but the, you know, democratic control of structures that are empowering instead of oppressive and so on. And this is what Rousseau also thought about an ideal society, yeah. No? I mean,
yeah.
Is his self-government, you know, self-governing community of Geneva or what it was, would this not be a kind of anarchism also in that it is a society that is self-governing and
maybe
where
is,
there are no imposed structures?
It may be, actually. So there are strong regulations, obviously, in a resource society. But in fact, the government is pretty small because the sovereign is not the government. The sovereign is the people. The government is simply here to enforce the law. But the laws are determined by the people and in a fairly democratic way through the general will. So you may say, well, the general will is utopia. It doesn't exist. It cannot exist. But anyway, let's assume it's a possibility. Then it is maybe it is, in fact, some kind of ideal anarchist society, which again confirms the idea that an anarchist society has regulations. They're simply self-imposed regulations.
Right. Then we have this idea of the social contract of this original state of nature. And this seems to somehow echo this Darwinian idea that you have the survival of the fittest and the strongest. And then from there on, human society through the social contract is negating this Darwinian evolution and replacing it with a model of organized cooperation. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't need to be so, right? I remember that Kropotkin had a different idea about this. He said that perhaps Darwinism is misunderstood in that we are not necessarily evolved to dominate others or to struggle for survival, and the survival of the fittest is not that survival of the strongest, is not necessarily the same. But he thought that humans have evolved actually in a Darwinian way, but they have evolved towards being cooperative and being beneficial to others and being in a state of mutual aid, you know, giving help to others and receiving help from others. And that this is now a natural state of human beings, and that therefore an anarchist society, even without a social contract, is a possible society because by nature we are good. And this seems also to echo some Chinese philosophers, right, who had the idea that man is by nature good. What do you think of this argument in favor of anarchism, that we are actually good, so we don't need to have laws in order to restrain us from doing bad things?
Yeah, so there would be kind of this, social and moral invisible hand, the idea that we are cooperate naturally. I don't know if this is true. There's certainly evidence that shows that people tend to cooperate. I think they always have. There's very few societies where people have just, lived independently from one another. And it does echo this Confucian idea. I don't know about man being, I think there's a debate about, in Chinese philosophy, about if man is by nature good or not. I think Mencius is saying something, Confucius is saying something else. Not an expert in Chinese philosophy at all, but for sure, at least, Chinese philosophy will emphasize the place of, our different roles in society and the role of cooperation, the fact that we are what we are in relation to others, and the meaning of life is basically to fulfill in the role you have been given. So you could say
we shouldn't talk of Chinese philosophy as one thing, right? You have Confucianism, which is very hierarchical, right? And there, even you could say this is totally opposed to the idea of anarchism, because one of the functions of the ruler is to be a ruler. And by being a ruler, he will provide an example to others who will try to follow him. And therefore, if the ruler is good, the whole society is good and so on, right? And you have this.
So no, I didn't want to say that, Confucius advocates for any form of anarchism. I really don't think that's the case. But it just to show that this idea of cooperation is in fact something that we have evidence for. But then, well, that's always the same. You know, we, sure, maybe there is a natural tendency to cooperate, but we still end up disagreeing quite a lot. So how do we regulate that? You know, this is usually people who oppose anarchism will use this to argue for stricter regulations or like principles of justice, or, you know, to say, well, unless we follow these principles that we have, that have been agreed on, or that make the most sense, the most rational of principles, then we cannot never find an agreement. And then society will become a complete chaos.
Yes, and we could also imagine a Kantian argument for, strangely, right? Because Kant is not whom you would perceive as an anarchist. But we could imagine a Kantian argument favoring anarchism in the sense that human beings should not be treated as means only. And in the society we have now, obviously, this is the case. We are all being treated as means by our governments to some extent. We often get compensated for this by also being able within the society to realize some of our ends. But very often we are treated as means only when you think of debates like state surveillance you know, all this corporate life and advertisements and so on. There, people are clearly treated as means in order to generate more income for big corporations and more power for politicians and so on. And there could be a Kantian argument to abolish, you know, all these structures in society that lead to the commodification of people. And then this would be a kind of anarchist argument, or wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There is definitely a deontological argument against free market, for example. I think the it's interesting because Chomsky is saying this as well. Usually people who oppose anarchism or alternatives to capitalism, let's say they're libertarians, or we can call them libertarians in the sense that they value freedom of the individual above, you know, state regulations. But although they value freedom, they also are okay with people being subjected to the laws of the market and the economy in general. So they support subordination of people to the economy, which is a big form of oppression. When you think about it, what can you do against the economy and the forces of the market? So there is definitely a paradox here.
Yeah, and also this paradox, what you mentioned in the beginning, that actually the free market is seen as a kind of anarchist idea.
It is the ultimate anarchist society when you think of the absence of regulation. You know, it's free market, no regulation. That's what people want.
But at the same time, this market-based economy is treating people as means and not allowing them to flourish, like you said, right, to develop in freedom. Okay, so we saw a few of the criticisms. Excuse me, you wanted to say something?
No, I just wanted to add that that's why I'm very cautious of the idea of anarchism as absence of regulation, because at least I'm scared it would lead to an extremely libertarian argument, you know, which would lead to then this free market society as a perfect anarchist picture, and I don't think we want to go there.
Yeah, so but I don't understand. I don't understand how else, really, because if you say that anarchism is not the absence of regulation, then, okay, it's the presence of regulation. And then you say, now we need a regulation, so where does the regulation come from? Either it comes from some kind of democratic decision-making process, then you have a free democratic society like, you know, like the ones we have, essentially, and then you are not in a state of anarchism. Or you say these rules come from some kind of ad hoc rule making, and then you get the problem of justifying why these rules are just rules or good rules, as opposed to, you know, them being bad rules.
So I don't think that, you know, this system I'm presenting is the system we live in, like this kind of social liberal society democracies. These are not anarchist societies, obviously, because what we've done is that we've, you know, decided on a few things, and then we tell the government that they're basically legitimate in enforcing the rules any which way, and very often they do it on an arbitrary basis. And so then I'm more talking about a society where there are rules that are self-imposed and picked through a process of public deliberation. We still need to give the conditions for that, for the fairness of these rules. But I think also it includes the possibility of, you know, changing the rules very often, anytime the people consider they need the rules to change. And basically, it's the absence of a form of authority that imposes something on an arbitrary basis. It doesn't mean no regulation. I don't see the conflict there.
Okay. So I think this arbitrary basis is probably the key word, right? So you need to, like Chomsky also said, you need to justify why you regulate in a particular way. And often our systems that we have, these Western-style democratic societies, don't really provide a good justification for the rules they make. And so then anarchism would not so much be anarchism, but it would be more of the demand for more rational governing, or more open, or more justified, better justified government.
Yeah, again, using the word government is a bit problematic, but I think it's just simply, the imposition of rules that we have collectively picked.
So have there ever
really need a government for that?
Right. So have there ever been any societies like that? Do we have any examples where we can imagine that or look at them and say this is a good example of how we imagine anarchism to be? So one can think, for example, of some small indigenous tribes, the Amazon or something like this, that live within the confines of their village and then go hunting and gathering and have very little regulation that is imposed from the outside. Would this be something like that?
So I don't know. They're obviously all different. And I would guess that they're hierarchical societies. You know, you have leaders even in these societies. So I don't know how self-imposed the rules are. But you could assume that they probably live in a way that is satisfying for, you know, for most people in these societies. And after all, they've evolved to function this way, which could mean that this structure meets the requirements that, you know, people have. But I can't really talk on this because I don't know how they function exactly. You could think of this big example of the Parisian Commune at the end of the 19th century. There was a very short experiment where people kind of created for 2 months an independent society, and they had a different type of government that was elected, and they came up with a few new rules that were quite modern for the time, and you know, there was a big emphasis on the people and the people's needs and interests. And that's something that was extremely different from anything that had been done before. It did not end well, as the government just entered the city and started killing everybody. And something like, I think, 20,000 people died in this what is called a bloody week. So I don't know the historical facts precisely, but it's often used as an example of a true anarchist society that functioned really well because there were regulations, but they were simply regulations that the people had chosen, that they were happy with. And if they were not happy with them, they could discuss and change the regulations. I think this changing aspect is extremely important when we talk about anarchism, the possibility of removing whatever we don't need anymore and changing the rules.
Yes, but this is also not an encouraging, really an encouraging example for anarchism, right? Because it was not happy and successful, right? And then another thing would be, you know, the Israeli idea of the kibbutz, you know, a society where people live again in some kind of self-imposed order, or the Amish societies in the United States and some parts of the United States which are self-governing. But then again, it's not the absence of rules in these societies, right? An Amish society has lots of rules, and many people would say it has even much more oppressive rules than we have. But the difference is that the people who choose to be in these societies, who do not choose to leave them because they are in principle free to leave, right, if they don't like it, the people who choose to be there are actually happy with these rules, despite the rules being from the outside, you know, looking like they are very strong and perhaps oppressive. But the people who live inside the Amish societies seem to be happy with these rules and to enforce them themselves, right? So there is an absence of an organized government and policing and so on, because the people keep these rules by themselves.
And though you could say, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of Amish people who are very happy with the way they live, and probably most of them. Then you could also say that when you raise children a certain way according to pretty strict regulations and without providing information about much else, you kind of like remove options, you know, for them. So it's not like they are free to choose any kind of life they want. So, you know, you always talk about Amish kids who leave, they have to leave for maybe a year or something like that. I'm not sure how long. And then they can decide to come back or not to the community. Often they do decide to come back. I'm not saying this is wrong, but you could argue that they can't really not come back because they haven't really been provided with enough information to be able to deal with the world and have all the doors open, right?
So especially with education, right? I mean, the Amish young people have relatively little in terms of formal education, which is required in the normal Western society in order to apply for jobs and university and so on, right?
So I think the kind of ideal anarchist society maybe functions a little bit like the Amish society in this kind of like, you know, autarky system. But we still need to make sure people are educated enough that they have access to, you know, the external world if they want to, and that we don't reproduce these patterns of oppression within that society. And just a word about the Commune of Paris. It's not very encouraging, but it didn't work, but not because it's self-destructed, because the government did not want it to work. And so, you know, it came in and killed everybody. But we don't know. It could have, you know, evolved in something really great. We just never know.
Yes. So this is always difficult, right, in history to make these arguments with hypothetical, you know, outcomes of historical events, because we have only one outcome, the one that actually happened. And it's always difficult to say what would have happened in the same historical situation, because these situations never repeat themselves, right? But an interesting about now again, the Amish and the regulation, an interesting thought there is perhaps that we must distinguish when we talk about anarchism, what actually is the point? I mean, you said already multiple times that it's not the absence of regulation, but perhaps this is a common thing that people perceive as anarchism, as the absence of regulation. And so we must distinguish the absence of regulation from the happiness of the subjects with the regulation. So if this is a criterion for anarchism, then any regulation that keeps the subjects happy and where people agree with the regulation would also be an ideal society, which is not necessarily then anarchist in the sense that it lacks regulation, but that the regulation is voluntarily accepted and seen as meaningful. And if you see it like this, then the Amish society is, you know, within limits of every human endeavor, but it seems to be a relatively successful society. And also then you would see monasteries as an example of this. But because in monasteries you have the monks who voluntarily embrace all these regulations in a monastery, and a monastery is quite the opposite of a non-regulated society. It's a very heavily regulated society. But it is one that is absolutely voluntary. Every monk can just pack his things and go and become, you know, a non-monk. So the people who stay monks really voluntarily stay in this life because they perceive it as meaningful and good. And so they voluntarily accept all the rules of the monastery. And so then you would have to say the monastery is also a good example of what you said is anarchism. Not the absence of regulation, but the voluntary acceptance of regulation. Is this a thing, or is this now a counter-argument to your definition of anarchism? A monastery cannot possibly be anarchism, therefore your definition of anarchism must be somehow wrong.
Yeah, I hear you. Again, I'm not saying my definition is right. I think it is a possible definition and the one that most people nowadays would advocate for. But so this leads to the question of how autonomous people are when they pick a system or they live in a system. I think an ideal society is a society that promotes autonomy for people in it. You could argue that the Amish society does not do a good job at this, maybe because of a lack of information, a lack of education, a lack of representation of, you know, all available options. I'm not saying this is the case. And you could say that similarly with a monastery, although usually you choose to join a monastery as an adult when you have had the experience of life and you have, you know, been able to reach this autonomous state. So some people may say, well, you cannot possibly be autonomous and join a monastery or live in an Amish society because the structure of these societies are always in conflict with autonomy. And this is the idea of the Taliban wife. It's a classic example. The Taliban wife is subjected to the Taliban rules and can never be autonomous. But you could also say that, no, you can actually choose to put yourself under some kind of authority that you identify as serving your interests, and therefore you're still being autonomous. So obviously you need to evaluate a lot of things here, and I don't really have the answer to the question, but I think it is possible to surrender to some form of regulation because you consider that this is in your interest. This is serving you. So this is akin to obeying the law you impose to yourself, which is autonomy.
And autonomy doesn't need to be this very unsophisticated, you know, freedom in everything. It can be something like Frankfurt's second order autonomy or second order, you know, volitions, where you say, I am autonomous in deciding that I want to be a monk, and this is the root act of my autonomy, and I voluntarily agree to have my first level autonomy, if you want, restricted, because this will serve my second level interests or second order volitions, which is to be free from the world and to be in a contemplative state and to serve God and whatever else, you know, monks see as the purpose of their life. And so, you know, I don't think that this argument really allows us, the autonomy argument allows us to distinguish between different societies where one promotes autonomy and one doesn't. Obviously, yes, some societies don't promote autonomy at all when they force their citizens to do things that are against their will. But as soon as you have a choice, and you have a choice to submit voluntarily to some authority, then you cannot anymore say that this authority is not legitimate, right?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I have a bit of an issue with Frankfurt's argument, because where does the second order, you know, desire come from? What makes it more legitimate than the first one? And what if there is, you know, a third order and a fourth? There is this kind of infinite regress problem with it. But anyway, I agree that autonomy and freedom are different. So I like this example of Odysseus. you know, that illustrates the distinction between freedom and autonomy. Autonomy is kind of a higher type of freedom, if you ask me. So
can you briefly explain this example, what you just mentioned?
So Odysseus, you know, he is on his ship and he has his sailors with him, and then they encounter sirens, and he knows that the sirens will sing and he will be attracted to them and jump and they will kill him at the end. So he knows this. He has information, right? He's informed. And he tells the sailors, tie me to the mat of the boat so that I don't end up dying in the sea. And so they do this. And then the sirens sing, and he begs them to set him free so that he can go. But they don't do it because they've been told. So here, Odysseus is not free. He's not free to do what he wants. What he wants is to go. And he cannot, but he is autonomous because he's obeying the law he has imposed to himself as an informed agent, right? So which is, to me, the ultimate form of freedom. And this is what I think a true anarchist and a true ideal society should promote.
Right. But the same you could say of monks, right? I mean, they are...
Yeah, absolutely.
They make a free decision as grown-up people to... It's essentially the same, right? To be tied to this mast of the church or the monastery, so that they cannot submit to their... first order, you know, cravings for whatever this materialist society promises them.
I agree.
Okay, so I think we have covered most of what we wanted. It is in the nature of philosophy probably that we don't have any answers. It's okay to not have any answers, but perhaps we have a little more of an understanding what is involved in promoting anarchism or in understanding the problems of anarchism. Is there anything you would like to add at the end of this?
No, I think we raise questions we don't need to answer them, but maybe we you know, provided the listeners with some elements so that they can come up with their own answers, which is what our jobs are.
Okay, so thank you then. And let me remind you that there is this website, dailyphilosophy.com, where you can see more. You can find articles that talk in more detail about various philosophical issues. And we will be here next week. We will talk about technology and how technology affects our autonomy. And Ezekiel also has a special aspect on this.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about nudges and how they can impact our freedom in general, if they impact our freedom.
Okay, very nice. So come again to us next week, Tuesday. We will talk more. Thank you and bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone.